Welcome to the Robin Report podcast series, Radical Times Require Radical Actions, with host Robin Lewis. Each show, we feature stories and guests from the Robin Report online. For more information, visit therobinreport.com. Now, here is your host, Robin Lewis.
I'm Robin Lewis, and welcome to the Robin Report podcast series and our ongoing theme, Radical Times Require Radical Actions, where my guests and I provide unfettered insight into the inner working of the business of retail. I'm your host and founder and CEO of the Robin Report. And if I do say so myself, I don't think there's any other report like it. It is very provocative. It's in your face with really powerful expert opinions on every major event in the retail and brand worlds. We do connect the dots and enlighten our readers with strategic insights and perspectives that they really can't get anywhere else. So if you're not already signed up for our daily email blast, please go to my website, therobinreport.com, and sign up. It's free. Okay, I thought we should start our conversation with a big picture background for our listeners. And the big picture is the retail industry is in the middle of what I would call the perfect storm, which is like three violent weather fronts colliding at the same time. It really is disrupting everything in the old world of retailing and brands, and we are just now in the middle of literally building a whole new world. So the perfect storm, it's three violent weather fronts. The first being technology, and under that, primarily the smartphone. The second would be a whole new young consumer culture with an entirely new set of values and a new definition of just what value is. And a big part of it has to do with the fact that they're armed with the smartphone, which when you think about it, unbelievably, everything in the world is packed into that little device. So at the touch of a key, these consumers can have anything their heart desires, which means that the physical store is no longer the point of sale. With the smartphone, the consumer is now the new POS. Wherever they are, whenever they want something, how and how often. So, and the third part of the perfect storm is simply overcapacity. We are overstored, or any way you want to describe it, and which, by the way, has been a growing issue ever since it was identified in the early 1980s. Between then and now, on average, retail space has been growing about 4% a year, population growth of maybe 1%. So these major dynamics and with many offshoots are forcing the fundamental transformation of the old retail and brand models and the explosion of new startup models, including Amazon, I might add. Bezos continues to say that they are in startup mode. So our theme, Radical Times Require Radical Actions. And for those who don't create radically new visions, objectives, and strategies to get it done, they're simply not going to be around. And by the way, as an aside, the Robin Report is going to be searching throughout the legacy traditional brick-and-mortar retail industry to find radical thinkers and doers within those companies who we judge to be entrepreneurs and innovators who are driving their company's successful transformations. And the Robin Report Radicals program, in collaboration with SAP, will be unveiling and celebrating these radicals all during 2020. And speaking of radicals, we are very honored and fortunate to have three radical thinkers and doers joining our conversation today. And they are truly experts on our discussion topic, which is educating an industry. In fact, all three of our participants are educating the industry in their own unique ways. Don Unser, for example, is president of NPD's retail group, which is the sixth largest market research firm in the world, and I think the largest source of consumer data in the United States, which Don will talk about in a couple minutes. Zia Wigner is with us. She is Chief Global Content Officer at Shop Talk, and she's a co-founder of Grocery Shop, Retail Club, and Personata. And she's in charge of developing all sessions on the agenda of all of these events, including creating original content and recruiting senior-level speakers from innovative startups, established brands and retailers, investors, real estate developers, and more. By the way, Shop Talk and Grocery Shop are the largest and most powerful education platforms during a three-day period in the industry. They assemble thousands of senior executives from both the legacy old world of retailing and the tech-driven new world. Shop Talk and Grocery Shop develop a brilliant curriculum where they bring in experts and C-level operators, academicians, and relevant consultants, all who provide learning platforms for the attendees. And finally, Steve Sadoff, who actually needs no introduction in both the consumer packaged goods and retail industries. He's had senior executive roles in both consumer and the retail industries with 27 years in the consumer packaged goods industry, including CEO of Clairol and senior roles at Kraft General Foods. He's a former chairman and CEO of Saks, and chairman of the National Retail Federation. He currently sits on numerous public boards, including a chairman of Aramark, lead director at Colgate Palmolive, as well as Movado and Park Hotels and Resorts. He's a senior advisor to MasterCard, and he's a founding partner of JW11 Management Partners, a private equity firm. So with that background, Steve is highly sought after consumer, after consultant, advisor, teacher, and educator. Back to Don Unser. Don, please give us a little more color on NPD and what you do there. And by the way, how and where does NPD collect the tons of data you have, especially how powerful it is in defining the behavior of the consumers I just mentioned. So Don, give us a little color.
Thanks, Robin. I am very happy to be on with you. Thank you for having me on, and especially happy to be on here with Zia from Shop Talk. I'm a big fan and have been going to the event since the first year, and Steve, who I don't miss when he's out there giving his opinion on retail, on CNBC, and other media outlets. So it's a pleasure to be on here, Robin. NPD is a privately held market research firm, 54 years old. We cover 21 industries, mostly retail, but we also cover restaurants as well. Some people think that's in retail, some people think that's out. But in four of those industries, we actually cover worldwide. So we have a lot of data that we look at across a lot of different industries. NPD helps clients inform and track their core strategies. That's what we do. Our data collection methods span from getting data from retailers, from their point-of-sale systems, which we get data in the U.S. here from 750 retailers, and pretty much all the big names in the industries that we cover. We also do surveys. We also are putting a lot of work into tracking receipts, just because there's a lot of great information on there. We consult directly with the top firms in each of our industries. From a micro use of our data, we track market share right down to the item, and we help both brands and retailers figure out how they're performing against the rest of the market. From a macro standpoint, Robin, and you know of some of our engagements on this, we consult with CEOs and their staffs to help them prepare for their quarterly presentations to Wall Street or others.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in here. Don, I'd like to jump in here and say that.
Sure.
I don't believe there are too many people out there, executives from various industries that understand at a macro level what you guys are doing. So I'm glad you're mentioning that.
You bet. And the biggest application of our data is helping clients figure out where there's opportunities and where there are trends. And the consumer is driving so many trends. But like you said, with the shift in e-commerce, and we track mostly the discretionary categories, which got hit first by the digital disruption of Amazon and other platforms. And so we track clients or track the industry for clients to help them figure out what they should be doing. And data is a strategic weapon, Robin, and you have said this many, many times, and best-in-class companies are using that weapon to win.
Yeah, I think you have said if these retailers and brands today are not data-driven, they are dead men walking.
Yes, very much.
Okay, thanks, Don. And I have to believe there are very few listeners who have not heard of NPD. But I also, as I mentioned, I think of the macro point of you guys really advising C-level people in terms of what the underlying data really means and helping them build strategies. Okay, so Zia, I would like you to add a little more color for us on Shop Talk.
Sure. I'm glad to jump in. And Don, thanks so much for your kind words. As you mentioned before, Robin, we are a relatively new event targeting large brands and retailers, venture-backed startups, investors, real estate companies, tech companies, really runs the gamut. And we started 5 years ago with the idea that there was no single event that brought together at a large scale all of these different parts of the retail ecosystem. So there were, certainly events that did a great job working together with the traditional brands and retailers. There were others that were targeted at investors, still others for startups. But we felt like all of these different pieces needed to come together in order to move the retail industry forward, because we're at a time when there is just unprecedented amount of change in this industry. So we started in our first year with about 3,000 people. We're now over 8,500 a few years later. And in the meantime, we've launched our other event, Grocery Shop, which looks at innovation in grocery and CPG in a similar way to what we've done with Shop Talk. We bring together the different parts of those industries, but with a much more specific focus on those two rather than going broadly across all of retail. So we hold our events in Vegas every year. We actually just wrapped up Grocery Shop last week, and then we'll be headed into Shop Talk in March. So we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I have to add a little side story here. When Anil Agarwal, who is the founder and CEO of Shop Talk, he reached out to me, I think, a year before before you launched in 2015. And I'd never met him before, and I sat down with him over coffee, and told me what he was going to do. And I said, Anil, first of all, the world doesn't need another conference. But I said, if you can achieve all the things you're talking about, I'll certainly support you. And, of course, they've done it in spades. I just had to add that in. Anyway, and by the way, if any of you out there in audio land who have anything directly or indirectly to do with the retail and grocery industries, you really must attend their two events. One is in the spring and the other is in the fall. And I'm sure if you go to Shop Talk website, you can sign up for them. Okay, let's jump into the conversation. And by the way, throughout our discussion, please feel free to jump in with a comment, a different opinion, whatever. We want to keep this informal and provocative. So, Steve, the first question is going to be for you. I'd like to take the notion of the consumer as point of sale, wherever they are, on the beach or in the bedroom or in the kitchen. So if they have that access to everything in the world, why do they ever need to go to a physical store. A building full of stuff, as I've said before. And of course, a lot of them are closing. I think 12,000 are estimated to be closing this year. On the other hand, there are a lot of opening stores. So anyway, Steve, if you could comment on that.
Sure. Starting point is that physical stores are still an integral part of the ecosystem. You have enormous growth. The internet is growing, let's say, in aggregate at about 18%, and physical stores are flat or marginally growing in aggregate across all sectors. People still want to go to a store. 80-90% of commerce is still being done overall in a store. And people experience, they like experiences. They like to play around, touch, feel product. What they really want is, and you're right, technology, smartphones driving behavior. And it probably affects 80% of the decision making. So nobody's going to go and shop for a car without going onto their smartphone or the internet and understanding all the functions and features and pricing on the car. So, but they still are going into the car showroom largely to buy it. And I feel that people are still going into a physical store, even in categories. You know, the internet piece of it, delivery is growing, but take the grocery channel, it's still 95% physical store. And even in the apparel world that we grew up with, people are going into a physical space, but omnichannel has become pervasive, meaning that people want it anywhere, anytime they want, and they want to be able to mix and match across technologies.
Yeah. You know, interesting, Best Buy is a real large, you know, great example. They were being crushed to death between Amazon and Walmart. Steve, you probably know this better than I do.
Sure.
But they turned it around by inviting every major brand from Amazon to you name it, all of them, to operate physically in their stores. And what the consumer gets when they go to a Best Buy is they get a selection of all of them, plus they get an education from because each one of them has a little shop in Best Buy. So there they've made a real experience out of the physical space. So you're right.
But you can't just be experience. You have to couple it with the convenience and the value. And if you don't hit on all three of them, the experience, the value, and the convenience, I think you're, back to your word, dead man walking, I think you're going to have some real issues over time. But anyone who's thinking stores are dead or that there isn't shopping going on in stores is just wrong. It's really the combination of both.
Yeah, and I think Brian Cornell at Target's another good example. He's really turned Target around with the store at the core of his strategy, which is very interesting. So also, are some of these major physical players, what about some of their, small store strategies, like Target, for example, who's actually moving small footprints into neighborhoods and college campuses. And then, of course, there's Nordstrom Local. So what do you think about that? And do you see that as something that's going to continue going forward?
I think you're going to continue to see innovation in format in general. As you said, we've got lots of store closings and you have lots of store openings. We probably have 3 to 4 times as many stores as we need, but you're going to, I think over time, see lots of innovation in format. And it's this blurring. You really have to, because of the segmentation of the consumer, because of as we'll talk more about who the consumer is and what they want, they do want different kinds of formats. And everyone's testing and playing with what's the right format in an urban market. What are the different ways of delivering using technology, using the omnichannel experience, using that to complement smaller store formats. And there's not one answer. Every retailer has to look at what is the right answer for them. What's happening is you're seeing a lot of innovation at play.
Yeah. You know, you frequently have spoken about this. on CNBC and other venues where I've heard you talk about fragmentation, which is really what you're talking about now. It's fragmentation of consumers, as well as the fragmented field of commerce. As you've said, all the different platforms and channels, and also the fragmenting of retail, such as which you didn't just mention now, but you have renting, swapping, and resale.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and you have brand fragmentation. The consumer wants differentiated, segmented brands. So there's the brand side of it. There's the retailer side of it. There's the channel side of it. There's the type of commerce, whether it's resale or rental or buying the product. So all of this, it becomes a Rubik's Cube of all these differentiated ways that the consumer, that you have to think about going to market.
So Don, does your data capture this kind of fragmentation that we're talking about?
It sure does, but I want to make another point on something Steve put out there, just a proof point to Steve's sage comments that he made about this. So e-commerce and the blending of it with stores is the winning formula. Omnichannel is a word that's thrown around a lot, but we are seeing an inflection point right now in the first 6 months of the year. We are actually seeing the retailer.coms in e-commerce grow faster than the platforms of Amazon and others. And I think, Robin, that's an inflection point of how big were the platforms going to be. And then the retailer.coms started finding their stride, and stores plus the digital asset, as Steve was saying, is the winning formula for sure. What you were talking about with some of these rent, and that is definitely affecting mainstream retail, or what you called old world retail, Robin, that you have referred to in the past.
Right.
We are seeing it, whether it be the rental, the re-commerce, the thrifting, all of these things are alive and vibrant. And we're working with clients, both retailers and brands, to try to figure out how can they have a role in that. And I think both retailers and brands are going to have to really change their thinking of we only deal with A goods, they need to adjust to what the customer wants.
Yep. And excellent point here. And over to Zia, which this is a part of kind of what we're talking about right now. From Zia, from your immersion really in the tech-driven world of digital natives, I mean, I don't know anybody who's probably had more experience than you guys at Shop Talk and Grocery Shop. We see many of the more successful ones opening physical stores, like Warby Parker, Rent the Runway, and many others. And then on the other side, some of them being acquired by the legacy physical brick-and-mortar guys, like Walmart buying Bonobos, Moose Jaw, supposedly building a long-tail model there. So can you give us a little light on why is this happening, and will it continue in your opinion? And Steve and Don, you can jump in as well.
Sure. So the first point around opening physical retail locations, and some of these brands are loath to call them stores because they serve different purposes. But I think, as you mentioned, a number of the large ones have gone this direction. They've realized that the touch and feel component is, in fact, important to the business. I will say, however, though, that most of these brands have only, one or two or, up to a handful of stores. Sometimes they might, launch a flagship store in Soho. There are exceptions. There are the Warby Parkers of the world. More recently, you've had brands like UNTUCKit announce that they're going to open 100 stores over the course of 5 years.
Wow.
Madison Reed, a hair care brand, plans to open 600 stores over the next 5 years. 500 of those will be franchised. 100 of them will be company owned. But there are some of these brands that are going very strongly into the physical locations and are looking to to that area for growth longer term. I will say though that particular approach is in some cases secondary in terms of revenues to the wholesale route, which is sort of the the other piece of this puzzle. So you've had these digitally native brands that have traditionally just sold direct online. As we've said, some of them are opening stores. but a lot of them are now striking partnerships with traditional brands and retailers, traditional retailers, and that really is generating, you know, a large percentage of sales for some of these brands. So they're starting to resemble more traditional brands by, you know, embracing these other approaches and a little bit less like the digitally native brands that, you know, that they were just a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to build a little bit on Zia's comment, you know, several of the brands, we'll use the Warby Parkers as an example, have gone out and talked about that when a physical space is opened up, and it could be within a wholesale account or in their own store, they're seeing 3 or 4 times the impact on their own website. So you get this synergistic effect of the .com business being accelerated growth because of the physical store presence, either their own or wholesale.
Yeah, that's a whole other aspect to this. Another one, which we don't need to go into. I mean, it's probably another show on its own. But, you know, most of these the digital pure players, you know, are still being funded by investors. And, you know, 9 out of 10 of them aren't making any money. But the investors continue to pour billions of dollars there. And all of a sudden, you know, they're scaling overnight. But, you know, you take Uber, for example, it's losing billions of dollars. Anyway, not to get off on that, because that is a whole other subject. So next question I have for Don is, so as you mentioned, retail as data-driven or you're dead man walking. Another thing about the power of this young consumer is they want special for me. They want when and where I want it. And now, and immediately, and with an experience, also free delivery. So all of these elevated expectations and demands, because they can, it has given rise to an overused and often, I think, misunderstood kind of buzzy word, personalization, which I have said, obviously, if retailers and brands can drill down into learning in detail the personal behaviors of each of their millions of consumers and then can fulfill each of their desires, they're going to have a huge competitive advantage. In getting and using that personal data, which is now with possible with technology today, on a ranking of 1 to 10, in my opinion, the legacy industry is around 2 or 3. And Amazon, as we all know, is probably around a 9 or a 10. I mean, if you buy your paper towels from Amazon, for example, you might find a box on your front porch without even having ordered it because they know your buying cycle. Stitch Fix, for example, the apparel subscription service, they send a regular stream of clothes on a monthly basis or whatever cycle you want because they know the stuff you want. All of this is accomplished through artificial intelligence and huge data analytics. So Don, can you talk about this and how NPD kind of adds to this process? And Steve, you jump in as well with your direct experience coming out of Saks. So Don, give us a little more on this subject.
You bet. Thanks, Robin. So the consumer is clearly in charge in the retail ecosystem, and they have been for some time. And the retailers and brands that embrace that and let the retailer take that or the consumer take them where they need to go are the ones that are winning. There's so much data out there that's available, Robin, and one of the things we do is we rarely go to a company and they say, whoa, we have too much, you know, we don't have enough data. Every company is drowning in data, whether it be their own data, whether it be data that they're getting from third parties, whether it be data that they work with us on. So helping them synthesize that and say, you know, what data is important for their strategic decisions is really the important piece. The number one brand, and I'm quoting this from Marshall Cohen, who's our chief analyst, the number one brand that people are investing in is their own brand, period.
Wow.
And there's more and more and more evidence of that. Marshall does this whole thing on brand me, M-E, that is there's just so many proof points of what's happening with that. As far as what NPD does to help clients with that, Softlines is going through a rapid casualization. It's been happening for some time, but in some subcategories, it's just in turbo mode of more casual clothes and more casual looks. And you got to catch that trend on the front end. And so we're helping clients catch things like that. If we can help them early and then lean into it, that's kind of an important thing. But the one thing I wanted to mention too on this personalization, we always go in personalization to soft lines, Robin, but personalization is happening in lots of categories in retail. And some examples, tech with headphones, all the colors of Beats, small domestic appliances. This is really interesting. In 1955, that KitchenAid mixer, there were only three colors. There was a petal pink, sunshine yellow, and satin copper. There's now 90 colors of the KitchenAid mixer that's available to the consumer.
Yep.
So the consumer's in charge. They have an amazing amount of selection out there, more than they've ever had before, and it's really fun to wade through the data and try to find retailers and brands how they go to market with all this information.
Amazing.
Yeah, I guess I'd just build on this whole discussion on the data and analytics. And I agree with Don that there's a lot of data that's out there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily translate to knowledge. And the dilemma that you have is you have this inundation with data, but you don't have the talent or the capabilities in a lot of the retailers to be able to translate that. Obviously, that's the role of the NPDs of the world, the MasterCards. I mean, there are any number of players out there that are trying to help do that. But right. what Robin, you're talking about this, the level of capabilities are at the 2 to 3 in a lot of these retailers. Remember, most of the people who are leading these organizations didn't grow up in the world of analytics.
Right.
They grew up as merchants. They grew up as store people. And you're now trying to bring in a whole new genre of talent into the organizations. That has to be developed. You have to really understand what are the right questions to be asking. So you're in a really new world where the analytics, you're trying to figure out how you're going to be doing it. I'm not so sure I agree that the Amazons are up at the 9 or 10. I think that they're a lot better, but I don't think they're as good as 9 or 10. And the within the world of more traditional retailers, I think there's enormous amount of variation. That yep. you have some that are down at the 1 and 2 level, and you have others that are have moved up probably to the 4 to 5 level. And that's where this massive opportunity is, harnessing that data and turning it into knowledge and a better understanding and better tailored products for the consumer.
Yeah, and I think that adds to Don's comments on the fact that they've got micro, but more importantly, that they're doing the macro, and they are helping C-level guys who are running the businesses to how to analyze this data and what analytics to use, and then how to analyze it, and then how to strategize it. Correct, Don?
Yes. And there's some new tools coming out, for example, that show when a customer has been buying your brand or been shopping in your retail store, and the minute they leave and start shopping somewhere else. Well, that's invaluable for clients to understand. Why am I losing a client? And just as important, why am I gaining a client? And who did I gain them from? If it's a retailer that's launching a private label, what was that customer buying in that category before that they then switched over to the retailer brands of private label? And that should educate the retailer on how they should price it, how they should position it, on where they came from. So there's amazing applications out there for the information, Robin.
Yep. Okay. Moving on. Next kind of open question. What about the big shift in marketing and how fast a new brand can be scaled? I mean, this is phenomenal. I mean, you got Allbirds, Supreme, Kardashian. I mean, this whole social media influencer marketing, platforms. Steve, what's your take on this? And Don and Zia, you can jump in as well.
Well, in the old days, it used to be share of shelf equaled share of market. And what I mean by that, it was mega brands dominated by national advertising, dominated by who controlled the shelf on, if it was a grocery business, it was on a Walmart or wherever you were dealing with. And as we move into this world of fragmentation, segmentation, and the moving away from the national television print being the drivers of marketing, you're into these, and the changing consumer, you're into this segmented marketing. And the role of, if in my old life as a retailer, it used to be the sales associate was the expert. This dress or this outfit looks great on you, and that was how you made the sale. Now it's all about the influencer, the blogger, that this, your friends may be your best salesperson. You take a photo of it and send it out to your interest, your friends, and they tell you whether it looks good or not. And so the role of the influencer has dramatically changed marketing, and the ability to scale it quickly and the number of followers, assuming they're real followers and not bought followers. But you've got the ability to drive a very substantial business in a relatively short period of time because the vehicles are different. And the old line companies are adjusting, but they're having a harder time adjusting. I saw one digital startup that was spending more in digital media and influencer media than one of the mega, let's call it top 100 brands a year or two ago. And now you're seeing these massive shifts going on how people are spending and understanding how to use marketing dollars.
And this is Z. I'll jump in here for just a minute. And I definitely agree with Steve. It's, created this whole shift in terms of how these brands are approaching marketing. But what's sort of interesting is it's getting to be harder and harder to cut through the clutter when it comes to some of the, influencer marketing and digital marketing tactics that these guys have embraced. So we're almost coming full circle. I actually had a panel of digitally native brands at grocery shop last week. And we were talking about, whether any of them would consider, developing their own TV spots, and none of them were willing to say, no, that's not the route that we're going to be going. Mass media is in some ways back in vogue again, because it's become challenging with so many brands now trying to differentiate themselves through these digital channels.
Zia, you're absolutely right. And one of the problems, even the cost, let's say the CPM, the cost per thousand of the Facebooks and the Googles on search, for example, are up maybe 50% in the last year. So you've got you're inundated with the number of influencers and clutter there. So you're right. You're seeing some shift back in the pendulum swinging back a little bit. But you still have all these massive fragmentation of numbers of brands that are fighting for it.
Yeah, and Robin, this is Don. The biggest disruption industry that we saw with the digitally natives in the last 5 years has been the prestige beauty market. And interestingly enough, in the last 6 months, we've seen that some of those disruptors have really slowed down, and the big brands are now driving the growth again. So it's going to be interesting to see, as there's disruption in each of these industries, and how it then can go back to the mainstream retailers and brands.
Yeah, if I look at the CPG space, I think a great example of it is somebody like a Procter and Gamble, because where it was they were getting eaten away by a lot of the upstart types of brands, fragmented. They're bringing back the innovation funnel, by bringing back a better understanding of the differentiated segmented consumer. You look at a company like that that's seeing some very substantial organic growth again.
You know, it's amazing. All the stuff we're talking about today, it indicates that we are still in the early stages, or maybe in the middle of this technology revolution, and we really don't know where it's going to end. And it's changing on almost a daily basis. I mean, this is really very fascinating stuff that you guys are talking about. Another overused word, but powerful, is this sustainability. I mean, this new young consumer wants to know that the product is environmentally conscious, that it's being made in humane surroundings, and it's healthy, and on and on and on. Is it going to stick? One example, Patagonia in the apparel area, they'll advertise a vest for Patagonia vest, for example, to say, don't throw yours away, send it back to us, and we'll renew it and fix it and send it back to you. So, oh, by the way, another little factoid, year in and year out, some $500 billion of excess inventory and apparel ends up in landfills or on barges to third world countries, and it grows every year. So, Don, in this area, do you guys have data on sustainability? And will it continue to be driven by these young consumers?
Yeah, there's certainly segments of the market that are driving sustainability. And I would take it one step further and even say social causes, Robin. And it seems to us there's a bit of a an unfair thing that goes on here. If you're a small company or a digitally native company or a startup and you are claiming that your company is at the center of it, is sustainable, and you started the company that way, you seem to get a lot of credit for it. And there's multiple examples of that. In beauty, there's Beauty Counter, what they're doing, and footwear with a sock company, Bombas, that that gives away a pair of socks to the homeless for every pair that they sell. And, of course, Patagonia, which is not a startup, but that's part of their ethos. They get credit for that. Big companies actually do the most good in sustainability, but get the least amount of credit for it. But as a big company, you better have a good story. When you do not want to be on the wrong side of the curve on being asked on any of the big sustainability topics that are out there alive and well.
Yeah, so...
staying on that topic for a second, look, the consumer is very focused, especially when you talked about the younger consumer, very, very concerned about ESG and sustainability and do good and a cause and a story behind the product. The thing that becomes difficult is that there's a lot of evidence that consumers don't want to pay a lot more for it. They want it, and it's very important to them, and the brand has to deliver against it, but they don't. It's not. They want organically grown cotton, but they don't want to pay more for it. So you've got this dichotomy in terms of desire for it, but not a willingness to spend more.
Thank you, Steve. And actually, that's a fair amount of the work that we've done around sustainability. Is big companies, big brands that have come to us and said, should we be pumping in, you know, the majority of our investment for next year into sustainability, and what will we get for it? So that's exactly what Steve's talking about.
Bottom line. Yeah, that's very interesting. We'll see how that ends up. There's another thesis that I've been talking about for some time. The fact that the new young consumer culture sees two worlds. They see an old world and they see a new world, and therefore they see old world brands and new world brands. So, for example, and I hate to use Ralph Lauren as an example, but I will, some of them would hear or see, you know, the brand Ralph Lauren, and they say, that's my grandfather's brand, or The Gap, or Victoria's Secret, which is in trouble. Is this just the beginning of a slippery, slow decline of the so-called old world brands? And again, Don, is there any data on that? And Steve, your comments as well, again, from an operator's point of view.
Yes, we of course track this, and we put numbers behind it for our clients. Two of the areas that I find most interesting is prestige beauty. Can an old brand, an old world brand, as you've called it, can they rejuvenate themselves in terms of appealing to the younger segments? And many of the big brands are having a real hard time with this. We are seeing, on the flip side of that, we are seeing younger consumers actually influence the brands that they use up to their parents and their grandparents in prestige beauty, which I find just absolutely really interesting. And then another example would be in the handbag industry. That's been one that had an amazing run up and then an amazing fall off.
Wow.
And the fact that they just could not keep that brand, their brands and their value proposition with the consumer fresh in a style way, and keep fashion forward, was just a fascinating study of how a market can balloon up and absolutely fall off the cliff and not really come back.
It's not an easy one. I mean, this is the history of brands over decades in terms of how do you stay fresh to the next generation. Mm-hmm. I think there are success stories. Look at a Louis Vuitton and what they collaborations with places, you know, companies like Supreme, yeah, where they're able to keep it fresh with a younger consumer and still be aspirational. Gucci did a very good job of it. So there are, you go through, there are a lot of examples, but one of the biggest pitfalls is you don't want to become your mother's or your father's brand, and you've got to find ways of staying fresh. And the lure of it's easy to whether it's more distribution, whether it's you get it fall into the all the pitfalls that you can of a brand of where growth is easy, and then all of a sudden it goes off a cliff. Same with the perception with who the brand is. So this is the art of branding, which is how do you, and it's not inevitable that it is going to fall off, but you've got to find a way of staying fresh to the next generation.
And I would say that whenever you see these lists of, for example, top brands for millennials, inevitably it's a combination of old and new. So you have the, the Nikes of the world that have been able to reinvent themselves and stay relevant. Right. Target, for example, often lands a spot on those lists as well. So it's not all bad news for traditional brands. It just means you need to be able to, constantly iterate and remain relevant.
Yeah, and use the as example of Target. 5 years ago, everybody was poo-pooing Target and saying it lost its Target, and then Brian yep. did a great job of restoring some of the magic. So it shows that it can be done, even on a business as large as a Target.
Yeah, and to reiterate one of the things Steve said, the canary in the coal mine on a brand losing this is when they radically change their distribution. And that really takes away from, potentially takes away or adds from where the consumer used to buy that product.
Yeah, and it's usually easy money. And that's why you see these broadening the distribution, changing the channel, changing the price points. And that's where they start to get in trouble.
So moving on here, Steve, you talked about fragmented channels and so forth and so on and different platforms. What do you think of the legacy retailers like Kohl's, for example, viewing their stores as platforms upon which they can really welcome and engage other synergy creating brands and maybe even competitors to either lease space or participate in their stores like Amazon?
I like what's going on. Remember, we're talking about transformational change that's going on in an industry, and there is no one right answer. Everybody's experimenting. I love what Kohl's is doing in terms of playing with Amazon, bringing different kinds of brands into the store, trying things. I mean, it's fascinating. Nordstrom is now taking returns from Macy's. So this is a changing world, and nobody knows exactly what the right answer is. Amazon coming into Kohl's is I think is intriguing, and it's generating a lot of traffic through the returns. Whether it gets conversion is up to Kohl's in terms of providing an experience and offering that the consumer wants. But I think Michelle's doing a good job of bringing some innovation to Kohl's.
Yeah, she is, for sure. And do you think that ultimately these kind of big box department stores and discount stores, you think that one day they might simply be realtors, kind of like the European concession model where they're renting or leasing their space?
Well, that's it's a complex question. At what price tier? You're already seeing it more and more at the luxury space where you're seeing lots of concessions in a Saks or a Nordstrom or even a Bloomingdale's at the higher end. So clearly you're moving somewhat in that direction. I think that where your starting point was, you have too many stores, and you're going to see an evolution of the model. But reality is the consumer, buying other people's goods and reselling them and not being vertically integrated is a tough business. And you either have to have differentiated product or you have to offer an experience or a value that is going to be appealing to the consumer. You got to win on all of those. So the department store model has been disadvantaged, and it has for a long time because of, is it convenient? The shopping in the malls, there are too many of them. So they've got to find new ways of differentiating. Kohl's is different because they're not in the mall. But being a mall-based operator, you really have to come up with how are you going to provide a differentiated experience?
Very good. And that's, again, we don't know where it's going to end up, but they're all different kinds of formats. So Zia, in your opinion, you know, having created the Shop Talk, as I said, the Shop Talk educational platform, and your immersion in the old and new worlds, how far behind do you think the old world is in adapting and infusing kind of the primary tech tools to transform themselves? Where do you think they are on a scale maybe of 1 to 10, and talk a little bit about that? And who do you think is ahead of the pack?
So it's interesting. When it comes to technologies, a lot of the big players are actually at the forefront of embracing them. If you look at, for example, you know, a Walmart or a Kroger in grocery, those guys are actually incredibly innovative when it comes to experimenting with new technologies. You know, when you think about, for example, autonomous delivery vehicles, you've got Kroger and Noro partnering, you've got Walmart and Udell partnering. So they're really at the forefront of exploring some of these tools. You know, similarly, in something like automated checkout, the big guys are very clearly at the forefront. I think the challenge comes in terms of how, you know, large organizations are typically structured and the cultures that penalize, you know, what they consider risk-taking within the organizations. And I know that's one of the topics we want to cover, but when we did a deep dive into, you know, what makes digitally native brands different, it really was around the, you know, the speed at which they can make decisions and how quickly they can, you know, bring products to market as well. It's this combination of kind of speed and agility that they have that the larger companies don't. It's less about them having more advanced technologies or being more tech savvy.
So that's also very interesting. We see, do you have any idea who you believe is kind of ahead of the pack in the old legacy world?
I mentioned both Walmart and Kroger, and I think both of those companies have been, you know, very innovative in terms of their embracing of technologies and you know, also, you know, their willingness to say, okay, this isn't working, so let's try something different.
I think, Zia, you've hit one of the most important topics here, which is culture. And it's not just spending the dollars on technology. It's changing an organizational culture. Everybody poo-pooed the Walmart acquisition of Jet at $3 billion years ago. And the fundamental change of bringing a Mark Lurie and a technology-based, speed-based culture into the Walmart fray has been remarkable in what it's done. And I think that using catalysts to change culture is really what this is all about. It's not so much who's at the forefront of just investing in technology. It's about who's been able to mobilize and change a culture to be able to make things happen within these organizations.
Yeah, and I think that is the most critical piece of this, Steve. I think that you've hit the nail on the head. It's when it comes down to it, it is more about culture than about anything else in terms of these businesses being able to adapt. And I think, you know, to your point before about Target, there are those that have, you know, that have been able to adapt how they're, you know, approaching new initiatives and think through them and the pace at which they operate. But for many of them, it still, you know, just remains this, you know, similar situation to when what they were at, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
You know, I think a culture, we could do a whole nother show on that. I think I'm glad you brought that up, Steve and Z. You're emphasizing, I'm sure Don would too, and I see it all the time. I think culture may be the biggest barrier, antiquated cultures may be the biggest barrier to transformation. And guys, with unfortunately, this is going to have to be a wrap. I would love to go on for another hour with you guys. You are three of the smartest and energetic and full of knowledge people that I know in the industry. Anyway, I must say that I have learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners would confirm that in closing this great conversation. I want to thank you guys very much, Don, Steve, and Zia, and maybe we'll do another show down the road.
Thank you for tuning in to the Robin Report podcast series. If you want to find out more behind today's program and what's next, be sure to check out therobinreport.com and sign up for our email list in order to be at the forefront of what's new in the retail and consumer product industry. Join Robin Lewis again for another edition soon.